Recorded live in chilly downtown Newtown, this is Rancho Notorious, a podcast about movies and other cool stuff. You can find this and all the other episodes of the show at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious. Welcome everybody to Season 2, Episode number 15 of Rancho Notorious. I'm Dan Slevin, and here with me in Wellington, New Zealand, we have Kaylee Carruthers.
Hello.
Lovely to have you here. How have you been?
Good. I'm good. I'm going through this sort of like winter end of festival contract ennui at the moment.
Oh, ennui. That's a very French thing to be experiencing at the end of a French film festival.
Yes, but not in the French term of boredom, but in the, it's like the listlessness, the English use of the French word.
Is there a French-Canadian version of ennui that's...
Well, no, the French, like the direct translation of ennui, it just translates to boredom.
Oh.
But when it's used in English, it meant like listlessness or like...
Existential.
Existential, yeah, but it's actually just boredom.
Oh. With us here in the Rancho studio in Wellington, New Zealand, we have a special guest, Miriam Ross, the second person who's got the title of Doctor, who we've had here in the Rancho Notorious studio. Miriam Ross, welcome to Rancho Notorious.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
You're here to talk about your new book, 3D Cinema, Optical Illusions and Tactile Experiences, published last month. We have a copy to give away, and it is a significant thing that you have created.
Yes, it's been a lot of work, but happy with it.
Well, we'll talk to you a little bit about that later on, and about 3D. For those people who've been listening to this show since before it became what it is, you may remember in the previous incarnation of the show, I think, Miriam, you were our first ever guest on the show on our second ever episode, and I forgot to turn your microphone on. So for the entire show, you were a very quiet presence in the corner of the room. So I think, I'm pretty sure we've remembered to turn you on this time around.
Yes, I'll try and be much louder this time.
Excellent. Very good to have you here. Now, Miriam is here to help us with our reviews for the evening, as well as talk about her book and 3D, etc. Specifically, she's going to help us with Fast and Furious 7, evidently the biggest film in the history of ever. We're also going to be talking about Nakash and Toledano's
Samba.
Follow-up to a film that I can never remember the name of. I like to call it The Irreversibles or The Incomprehensibles. Or
oh, The Irreversibles, that doesn't sound good.
No, the Introvertibles. But anyway, the new one's much easier to remember. It's called Samba, and we'll be talking about that. And no doubt when we get through our rundown of the box office, we'll talk about all the other films we've seen. We should probably...
like the one I've been waiting months to see.
Yeah. Okay, don't let me move on without talking about that one then, because it's very important to you. But before we go any further, Kaylee, we've got a fortnight's worth of mailbag.
We do, yeah. Starting out with the incredible Fred Thompson, who sits through so many films.
He is what I used to be.
Yeah, it's incredible. Especially since he sat through The Longest Ride, and his two-word review for that is sore bum. 139 minutes of predictable drama, lacking any real tension or guesswork, and yes, 139 minutes of your life you'll never get back.
And that's long, isn't it? But I reckon there's something to do with films that are for fans now. They don't seem to have the same constraints anymore, that, you know, that fans want to be in that world, the Sparks world, for as long as possible, and so they just keep spinning it out. Like, there's no sense of the fans won't get bored.
No.
Interestingly, Sarah McMullen, another previous guest on the show, was not quite so scornful of that show, of that film. She thought that it was a little bit better than perhaps that two-word review.
Well, there you go. Also from Fred Thompson, two-word review for A Woman in Gold, Juggling Act, takes on too many themes and underdeveloped arcs. However, Mirren and Mislani are excellent. Speaking of Canadians, I love Tatiana Mislani. If you haven't seen her show Orphan Black, you should definitely go check it out, because she's so good in it, because she plays so many characters.
Oh, really? Orphan Black? Is that right?
Yes.
Is this a show that we should be watching?
It's very good. If you're into sci-fi and, like, biological sort of sci-fi drama, it's very good. It's not, like, amazing. It is a bit clunky and Canadian feeling sometimes, but very good.
Clunky and Canadian feeling. You know, I would have thought that sounds like a beautiful thing.
Yeah, but the story is very intriguing, and Tatiana Maslany plays, I think in the first season, she has a number of characters, and every season it expands. And the new season is premiering soon, like in a couple of days. It seems like from the trailers, there will be even more characters. So.
Right. Okay, so we'll put it on the list. And along with a TV show that I've been reading a lot about recently, because it's coming to an end, haven't seen any episodes, would love to know what other people's opinions are of this. Is this worth my time? Justified. Anybody seen it?
No.
Nope.
No.
Timothy Oliphant from Deadwood.
Oh.
And I just get the lots of people that I follow on Twitter, particularly US people I follow on Twitter, are just besotted with this show, and it's coming to the end of its run at the moment. Anyway, so maybe listeners can tell me whether it's worth my time. We are pretty much overwhelmed with high quality television at the moment, and there's only so much you can watch in an evening, particularly when you're trying to catch up with movies as well.
And it's April, and lots of things are opening.
Oh, yeah.
So.
And to make things even worse, as if I didn't need any more things to be excited or obsessed with, we in January bought Sebastian, who's our preteen, just preteen correspondent to Rancho Notorious, for his birthday, he got an Xbox, right? And this is the first time that I've ever had one of those things in my house. And God damn it, if I don't lie awake thinking of FIFA. life was so much less complicated when I didn't have games in my house. I used to think, oh, games, phew. And now I know totally why people...
I bet you could find an Xbox version of Polo.
Yeah, actually, that would be fun. Yeah. I would have to learn to speak Spanish to be able to, like, order the ponies around.
Another one of our favorites here at Rancho, mostly because she came all the way to see us, Marie O'Sullivan, Reese Pie, two-word review for Wild Tales, Gleeful Vengeance. You shouldn't side with them, but you do. Definitely one of my highlights at NZIF last year.
Right, and I've got a screening of that next week, I hope, a media screening, although work has been so horrendous over the last few weeks that I've had to basically can out of every single media screening that's been offered to me for the last 2 weeks. Mm. It's a Leviathan. I had a chance to see Leviathan this week, and I had to say no.
Oh. But the exciting thing about Wild Tales, I mean, it is one of those films that played at NZIF that has taken quite a bit of time to come back. But on my road trip, when I went overseas, every festival I went to was playing Wild Tales after NZIF. So it's one of those things that's like, yeah, way to go, Bill.
Well, this is, I think pretty much everything plays after NZIF, doesn't it? I mean, I'm just starting to read US reviews for The Salt of the Earth, you know, the Salgado documentary. And of course, that was picked up pretty much straight out of Cannes by Bill and NZIF last year. And I think that that New Zealand audiences are still not quite getting the fact that just because they haven't heard of something in the NZIF program doesn't mean that they won't be hearing about it a lot in the months afterwards.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And another tweet, it was sent to me at my personal account, but I feel I should share it. Very exciting, from Reese Pie, that they are definitely going ahead with Magic Mike, the musical.
Oh, yeah.
On Broadway. So anyone who's holding out for that news, it's happening. If anyone wants to plan a road trip, I'm happy to go.
Now, in Wellington on Friday, it's the opening night of the stage version of Singing in the Rain, the musical, and in the front two rows you get a rain poncho because you were going to get rained on, right? Because it's Singing in the Rain. I'm just wondering if there was going to be any kind of similar arrangement made for the Magic Mike audiences, the front row, whether they would need some kind of drool protection or something.
I won't go into the rumours. Anyway, that is our mailbag for the week.
Oh, well, and also Reese Pie was very kind to tweet out this morning, actually, a link to Rancho Notorious, to our last episode, because of the photos that I took from behind the scenes at on the set of Thunderbirds.
Yes.
Go.
And for the record, I retweeted that. Dan didn't retweet his own photos. It was me.
No,
so.
That would be... I'm not above doing that. So,
just to clarify.
Yeah.
That was me.
We are a team. But it was that was great of her, and which reminds me that, of course, in New Zealand, Thunderbirds Are Go screened on Sunday night, the very first episode, 12th of April it screened. So 7 o'clock on Sunday night's prime time. Again, it would be nice to hear from people what they thought of it, because I saw a couple of episodes at that launch party and thought it was, you know, if I was 8, I'd be really into
it. And what channel is it on?
TV2.
So it should be on demand?
Yes.
Hmm.
Yes, is that the only way that people watch things these days?
Well, no, I'm just wondering because I don't have a television, so.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, I don't do the broadcast TV on demand thing. And in fact, I was sent a link to a trailer for something that a friend of mine is in, and you have to sign up for TVNZ on demand to watch the trailers.
What?
This is insane. No, I'm not going to sign up to watch a 30-second trailer about something about World War One. No.
Strong opinion of the episode.
Huh.
No way.
All right. Thank you, everybody, who has written to us and made a contribution. And I hope that you all are coping with this fortnightly arrangement that we have here. It's pretty much the only way that I can stay sane. If we were doing this every week, I think my head would be exploding at this point. Kaylee, you have the non-Comic Sans version of the New Zealand box office report from the Motion Picture Distributors Association of New Zealand, so perhaps you could tell us
news. I'm going to do the top five and then digress a little bit, because the movie I was so excited to watch isn't in the top five, or even in the top ten. Opening at number five, Woman in Gold.
Should we talk about that now?
Let's do that. I like that. Okay. You know, let's do that.
Why not? Let's have a quick Woman in Gold. and okay, so fridge magnet fans of the world will already know about Klimt and you know, and this giant gold painting of a beautiful woman from the 1920s in Austria, and evidently she was a real person. Who knew? And the family that owned that painting must have commissioned it, I guess. The Nazis turn up in 1930s Austria and decide that they're basically going to take everything that they feel like. Flash forward to 1998, era of flip phones and pleated pants.
And Ryan Reynolds.
and
pleated pants with a flip phone.
Yeah, and with wire-rimmed spectacles. And he meets Helen Mirren, who is, in fact, the niece of the woman in the portrait, and she's a bit miffed, to say the least, about the fact that the Austrians are still claiming that picture as their own, and she wants, like, something done about it. He's a lawyer, so that's handy. So a long quest is commenced, and it's quite long, isn't it? It takes years. You've seen it?
No.
Oh, is this just me? I thought, yeah. You were enthusiastic before. I thought that you were going to have a back and forth.
Oh, sorry, I haven't seen it.
Oh, God, we need to brief ourselves properly, don't we, before we do this?
I didn't say that. We had emails yesterday. I never said I saw it. Sounds right. Great. Dan, continue.
Okay, we'll wrap this up fairly quickly. And it is longish. It is kind of repetitive. Helen Mirren is very, very high quality, as you would expect, although it is Helen Mirren in accent territory. And so if you were annoyed by her with the French accent in the Curry film that came out last year, then you'll probably be similarly frustrated by her in this. It's kind of a mannered performance, but a very, very high quality one. Ryan Reynolds is very sort of relaxed and, actually kind of non-hyper, for somebody who's been a comic book action hero. This is, and also, in some big comedies, there was a film where he played Sandra Bullock's secretary.
Yeah, Yes.
In Alaska. I can't remember what that was called.
The engagement.
The engagement, that's right.
Or something, the proposal.
There you go. See, you are.
Something like that.
You're way ahead of me on these things. But so, anyway.
We have to keep track of, Canadians have to keep track of our number of famous Canadians.
Of
it's
course,
important.
Yes, he is. That's maintain right. He citizenship. Is Canadian. And his wife is played by Katie Holmes, who we don't see very often these days. But the only problem is that apart from one sort of good Austrian, whenever they go to Austria, everybody else is very stern and inflexible. And when they flash back to the Nazis, there are, you know, all the Nazis are basically comic book strict, ruthless, brutal Nazis. And it just feels like, I mean, maybe this is the point. It just occurs to me that all of those stuff feels like what a memory of that time might be like rather than what it actually was. So maybe I'll cut the film some slack. But it was kind of frustrating because it did feel like those flashbacks were very much about cliched Nazis rather than any kind of real interaction that was going on between them. Anyway, I don't know if it's that much of a spoiler. Maybe it is. Probably is. Do I say how it ends?
No.
She gets the painting back, right? She gets the. So what happens is that at the end she wins. You don't need to watch this now. She wins. There are five paintings at stake, not just the one.
Oh,
right? Five.
Oh,
five.
Well, that's that.
Yeah. As I said to Karen on the way back, it's almost like they're the 1% of the 6 million. Anyway, you know, this is a family that is incredibly wealthy. They've got, you know, Holbeins and, you know, all the great masters are on their walk. So they lose a lot. They lose everything. So there are five of these Klimts that are in the Belvedere Gallery in Vienna. She finally gets them back. And then, according to the captions at the end of the film, she sells them all after all that for hundreds of millions of dollars and gives the money away. To be fair, she gives the money away. But it's like, I thought the point was that you were being reunited with your family in an artistic sense.
No, she's being reunited with her inheritance.
Yeah, that's apparently. Anyway, I'm sure listeners who know more about this are going to jump to her defence and explain exactly what was going on in reality.
And we welcome the discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. I chose not to go to Wikipedia to fill in the gaps on this one. Just assume that what I was being told on screen was, you know, the truth. Anyway, so that's Woman in Gold.
There you go. Do you have two words?
Yeah, it would be not sure.
So back to the New Zealand top five. In at number four, down or up from five, SpongeBob movie, Sponge Out of Water. Anyone?
We were very close to going to see that, but the timing didn't work, so we went to see Shaun the Sheep instead.
Oh, that's a number seven this week.
Yeah, Shaun the Sheep is actually really good. It's like a great silent movie. There's no dialogue in it whatsoever. So, you know, if you love the great silent movies, the Max Sennetts and the Charlie Chaplins and what have you, and you like Aardman, it's perfect for you.
Oh, sounds like a dream.
Yeah.
In at number three, up from four, Home.
Which was the one we were talking about before we came on here, the DreamWorks animation that opened 2 weeks before the school holidays. It's amazing that anybody's gone to see it at all. But there it is, ahead of SpongeBob.
Ahead of SpongeBob. Sitting pretty at number two again this week is Cinderella. And in the number one position, Fast and Furious 7. But before we get to Fast and Furious 7, I want to make a quick divergence down to number 12, up from 15, The Book of Life. Because I have been waiting to see this film since October. It was pulled from the release schedule in New Zealand. Mm. I'm pretty sure it was. It's meant to be released at the end of October, when it would have made sense. But now it's been dumped in the school holidays.
Because it's kind of animated.
And it's, because it's animated. It's not doing well because it's not in the right time of season.
And they haven't even bothered with, like, posters.
They have at Queensgate. There's a lot going on in the mall. That's about it. But anyway, so The Book of Life is produced, I believe, by Guillermo del Toro, an animated film featuring the voices of Diego Luna, who's also a beautiful singer, and
he does his own singing.
I think he does. Okay. I haven't actually looked it up, but I assume he does. He's probably one of those, like, super talented, super good looking people. And of course, voice of Channing Tatum. They play.
Does he do his own singing too?
He doesn't sing, actually. Oh. Yeah, no, he's the brawn.
Because that would make Magic Mike the musical, like...
that much better.
Yeah.
I don't think Channing Tatum will be in the Broadway show, though.
Oh, that's disappointing.
He's too busy.
Sorry.
So the Book of Life is a story about the Day of the Dead and the land of the dead and the land of the forgotten and, you know, all these... Mexican traditions around end of October, beginning of November. And so it's this really beautiful story, and it's these sort of bad kids. They go on a field trip to the museum, and this museum attendant tells them the story about the Day of the Dead and these three friends, two boys and one girl, and the two boys are fighting over who will fall in love with each one of them. And anyway, it goes on, and I'm not very good at explaining, but I really enjoyed it. It was a beautiful story. It was beautifully animated.
Is it stop motion animation, or is it a kind of digital 3D?
No, it's digitally animated. There's a 2D and a 3D version. Unfortunately, there's only daytime screenings. There aren't really any evening screenings to go watch it. So you really have to dedicate if you want to see it. But because the story is being told from another character's point of view, everyone you're watching are these little wooden characters. So it's very cute and very beautiful. And there's singing and there's sort of funny, like, 90s songs dropped in, which Liam at Flix didn't like. He thought it was like really cheesy and horrible and didn't work. I appreciated Radiohead being used in the film.
Oh, wow.
but I thought it was a really beautiful story. I'm really fascinated by that whole culture of, you know, celebrating and remembering the ones you've lost. It's very colorful and bright and exciting and a nice little love story. And it was one of those films that I was so excited to see and I loved so much. I was just sort of like weeping the whole time I was watching. Oh, wow. I was just like, it's so pretty. So anyway,
apart from yourself, singularly, who is it aimed at? Is it a kids movie?
It's a family film.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a family film. Maybe they felt that because Halloween isn't really big here, people wouldn't go see it or wouldn't connect with it. But I still think it would have been much more valuable being played in that October slot, where it would at least have some sort of reason for being released. You know, it's like when you release something like this in April, it doesn't really make much sense so close to Easter. So anyway.
All right.
I still loved it. I highly recommend it if you can go see it. I watched it in 2D. I couldn't get to a 3D screening because they're so limited, but it is beautiful and funny and very charming.
It's also, he said, trying to look along here, it's also only on, well, that's actually quite a lot, 63 screens. That's quite a lot. So you probably could find it if you really
want. It is. It's on at the majors, but there isn't really any screenings after 4 p.m.
Right.
So
sneak off work.
Sneak off work. Go see it. It's beautiful. And I'm so glad I finally got to see it because my little 2.5-year-old niece has been watching it on home video for months now. So jealous.
So, two words. You put me on the spot earlier on.
My two words would be colourful celebration.
Oh, good. Now, also in the New Zealand top 20, number 14, Dior and I, just briefly.
Speaking of crying.
We really enjoyed that when we went last week. Rather than repeat myself, we'll put a link to the Radio New Zealand 9 to Noon review that I did last week for that in the show notes, so you can find out a little bit more about Dior and I. But that gets a recommend from us. Now let's have a look at Australia. Well, it's my turn, isn't it? The Australian Weekend Top 5, The Longest Ride, which is... one of those Nicholas Sparks films, only starring nobody you've ever heard of.
Yeah.
Now they've just so Nicholas Sparks is now the reason why you go to these things, not Dave Franco or whoever.
Ooh, can you imagine Dave Franco and
Nicholas
Sparks?
It'll happen. Number 4, SpongeBob SquarePants Sponge Out of Water. Number 3, Home, which we've just talked about. It's basically the same as New Zealand. Number 2, Cinderella. Number 1, Fast and Furious 7. North America.
The North American box office in at number 5, Woman in Gold. Number 4, Get Hard. Number 3, Home.
I'm so pleased that Get Hard has just basically tanked in New Zealand.
Number two, The Longest Ride. And in the number one position, no contest, Furious 7.
Doug Dillerman tweeted a fact last week, which I haven't checked, but I would have no reason to doubt him, and that was that the opening weekend for Fast and Furious 7 in New Zealand was bigger than the entire New Zealand box office the weekend before.
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty insane, isn't it? Looking at the United States of America, North America, you've just done that, haven't you?
I just did that.
No, I was just having a look further down. Oh. Further down, see if there's anything interesting there. Because what have we got here? There's films I've never heard of. Do You Believe? At number 11. Do You Believe? And the distributor is called PureFlix. So I suspect that this is one of those films that's been for the people of faith community.
Yes. It Follows is in the top 10.
Wow.
Ah.
That's pretty good.
Way to go.
Yeah, and just on the subject of smaller films making money in the US, of course, What We Do in the Shadows cracked $1 million US box office last week. What's Danny Collins?
I was just going to say the same thing. If any of our listeners can identify Danny Collins,
yeah,
please let us know.
We are pretty much in the dark about that one. So you don't listen to us for facts, do you? You listen to us for opinion. All right. Talking of Fast and Furious. Oh, no, we're going to do looking at the script,
yeah.
Actually, rather than just making it up on the spot, which is what I would normally do.
Yes. We turn to our special guest.
We do. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Put you
Miriam.
On the spot.
Miriam Ross from Victoria University. When we first spoke to you on the show that came before this one, you were our sort of designated 3D expert. You specialise in the academic study of 3D. Why did you identify that as something that was even worthy of a specialist knowledge?
Yeah, well, I started around about the time when Avatar came out in 2009. And, you know, it was a big deal. Avatar was breaking records and everyone was talking about 3D again. But also everyone was saying, 3D is going to disappear in the next, you know, 2 or 3 years.
It won't
last. It's a fad, yeah. It'll be gone.
So like that surf movies.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought, I'm not so sure. And also, I kind of liked 3D, so it was that way of, you know, as an academic, it's nice to study something you like. So I wanted to see
what happened. Anybody else doing it?
That was the thing as well. No one else was doing it, so I was like, I can nail this field. So, yeah, there's a little bit of trying to get in there first. So I started looking at the films, and then, of course, what happened was when I spoke to people, people were completely divided. They either loved 3D, they thought it was the next big thing, or they hated it, and they couldn't understand why it was in the cinemas, why you had to pay extra for it, why you had to put on the glasses, all these things. So I thought, well, this is going to be a really interesting area, and it has been. It's been an almost 5 year process, 5-6 year process. So yeah, a long journey.
What was the biggest surprise in your sort of investigations?
Oh.
Because you've looked at the history of it as well, yeah. Not just the technology.
Yeah, probably, I don't know if I'd say it's a surprise, but the lack of, or the misinformation about 3D cinema. So, and going further back even than 3D cinema, 3D images. So few people know that there's been, well, 3D is called stereoscopic images, back since the 1830s. And that in the 19th century, in the Victorian era, these 3D photographs were more popular than, you know, 2D photographs, hugely popular. And then all this other information that people think, though, back in the 1950s, the movies had those terrible green and red glasses. And again, not true. 3D was kind of similar to what we have today. And again, just a few other bits of misinformation that people have about 3D. So,
and I guess the other thing that people would have thought about 3D before this digital revolution was that it was for pulp movies. Mm-hmm. It was not a serious artistic medium. Is that true?
No, there was a lot of those movies made, but Hitchcock did Dial M for Murder in the 1950s. With musicals like Kiss Me, Kate. So it was a real attempt to broaden out the genres. And yeah, there was quite a lot of silly movies. There was an awful lot of, from the 60s onwards, porn movies in 3D. So that was another niche. But yeah, there was a real diversity.
And actually, the good thing about, well, you wear those glasses and nobody knows that it's you in the theatre.
Yeah, back in the day when you would go to the theatre to watch
one.
Yeah, those skin flicks. Yeah, exactly.
You've got this book out now, 3D Cinema, Optical Illusions and Tactile Experiences. Tell us a little bit about when that looked like it was going to become a reality. Is this your first book?
This is my second book.
Oh, gosh. Well, that's two more than me.
Yes. My first book was based on my PhD on South American cinema, so this was a little bit of a change in tack. I knew I was going to write a book probably quite early on again because, like I said, no one else had really written the book on 3D cinema. There's some great historical accounts, some filmographies, but no one had done the more academic study of saying, well, how does 3D cinema aesthetically function?
And how does it work on the brain? Those sorts of questions.
Yeah, exactly. So I thought, oh, I can be the first person to write this book. And so I desperately scribbled away, hoping that nobody else would get one out before me. So I think I'm the first-ish in this field. But yes, it's been worked through in my head for a few years, but definitely the last couple of years. And huge things happened, such as 3D TVs became popular, 3D Blu-rays.
And then became less popular.
But it did mean that I could get a hold of Blu-rays, and not just recent films, but also I managed to get a hold of Dial M for Murder from the 1950s, Creature from the Black Lagoon, House of Wax. These are all 1950s films that people haven't seen in decades. So it made it a lot easier to study and write about the films.
Wellington is also one of the major centres in the world for 3D innovation and technology, with Peter Jackson and high frame rate and the stuff that's going on at Weta Digital. Have you had much support from those people out at Miramar for what you're doing?
We've had a little bit of contact, mainly because, as a separate strand from the book, with some colleagues, we worked on a 3D filming project with Te Papa Museum, which was really fun, where we filmed some of their objects in 3D, and some of the Weta staff came along and helped out. Sean Kelly, who is the stereographer on the Hobbit films, he very kindly took us to Jackson's Wingnut warehouse with all the cameras and showed us their incredible technology. And we'd been working up at the university on a what we thought was kind of a nice substantial 3D camera rig, and then we went down to Wingnut and saw their stuff and thought, oh wow. And of course we found out that even just the software that they used for the demo would normally cost $100,000 a day to run, those kind of crazy things. So yeah, we've had some nice contact. Sadly, The Hobbit didn't really make it into the book because there just wasn't quite space to talk about it. But I'm doing some other work around what The Hobbit means in terms of
High frame rate, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Yeah,
but it's a sequel.
Yes, there will.
That would be entirely appropriate, wouldn't it?
Yes. But Wellington and New Zealand itself is doing some really interesting things. Not just The Hobbit, but a little less known. There's been some other 3D films, the documentary about climbing Mount Everest, which has just gone out of my head, the name, but Beyond the Edge, exactly. So really great 3D documentaries. So.
Over the Hedge, that was the Hedgehog film, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Yeah. But yeah, Beyond the Edge, Liam Pooley's 3D film. So there's a lot of exciting stuff happening here right now.
And do you discuss in the book the difference between, genuine stereoscopic 3D and the post-produced stuff? And is that an area that interested you?
I touched on it just a little bit, but it is a really interesting area because when I started researching this, not long after Avatar, we had Clash of the Titans and Alice in Wonderland, which everyone thought...
were almost unwatchable.
Yeah. Mm. And an argument I've not really made in the book, but I've made elsewhere, is that I think we're at the stage when we just can't tell anymore. That it's become so good that it's really hard to figure out if it was filmed with two cameras or if it was just done in post-production.
So what does that mean for actually shooting in 3D then, if the digital post is so good now?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there's still value in shooting in 3D, and what often happens is that when you're shooting in 3D, you hire a stereographer who works with the director of photography. And so you've got someone that really understands 3D, that understands how the depth field should work. And that can happen in the post-production process, but often it doesn't. Often the 3D is just added on at the end. So, yeah, I think there's still some value in shooting in 3D and getting it right.
What's your favourite 3D film? It's Street Dance UK, isn't it? Come on.
It is. I mean, yeah, we've talked about this before. I think if I'm being academic and, you know, trying to sound impressive, I'll say, oh, it'll be, you know, maybe Wim Wenders' Pina or Cave of Forgotten Dreams by Herzog or, you know, Hitchcock's Tiling for Murder. But really, it's still Street Dance 3D from the UK. And the Step Up 3D franchise as well, you know. So,
well, yeah. Dance is actually, and you mentioned Pina before, you know, dance is actually one of the great uses for 3D, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, like it's one where you really, where nobody could argue the added value of it. I was going to ask you also, do you feel like you presumably also follow the business side of these things? And I know that I've talked to cinema owners who say that, you know, after the first week of a 3D release, they'll cut the sessions right back because it's too expensive for families to go. You know, it's only the real fans will go in that first week, and after that, it becomes much harder to find. Do you feel that the business side of these things, rather than the technology, is actually going to change how often we see it?
I think what's probably been surprising is that we've still got the premium for watching in 3D, because I think a lot of people presume that would disappear, and that's obviously a big issue, which is, you know, you've got to think, is it worth paying that extra money to see this? And I, you know, I think it is, because I love the 3D, but not everyone does. But I think what's interesting more so than that is what's happening internationally. So I know we're going to talk about Fast and Furious soon, but that was released in 3D in overseas territories, which basically means non-English speaking territories.
I did not know that.
But not here. So
so that would have been post-produced 3D for international territories, right?
It's been released in, I think it's IMAX 3D in some of these countries. So a huge deal.
Oh.
And this is a new trend that we're seeing. There's a whole bunch of films that are being made. I think RoboCop was one of the first ones. But lots that are only getting 3D releases in India, China, other markets.
So that raises yet another interesting question, and that is, and I think we talked about this a little bit a while back on the subject of Avatar, but I think it still rings true today, and that is, from an academic point of view, which version of a film is the text? Which version of a film is the definitive one that we're supposed to be treating as the...
Well, this is even harder with the Hobbit trilogy, because you've got your higher frame rate version, you've got your normal 3D version, you've got your 2D version. I think from a film scholarship point of view, I think it's a great question. It just shows there is no original text, but that doesn't really help anyone.
Oh, okay. Wow. So, yeah, that actually, and I could see that there would have been a lot of Fast and Furious that would have benefited, you know. So in terms of places like India and China, is that because they are later in the 3D excitement curve than everyone else, and it's just going to fade, or is that a cultural thing?
It's a really good question, and I think it's one that's just not been explored enough, because it's very easy for people to make kind of base assumptions, such as it's cultural, such as, oh, these overseas communities, all they want is gimmicks and flashes, and they're not interested in narrative, which would be a very unfair thing to say.
But I remember back in the 80s, people saying, oh, that's why Schwarzenegger and Stallone became and later on Nicolas Cage became the biggest, those enormous international stars, is because they didn't talk very much. They just punched things.
Yeah, so I think it would be simplistic just to say that these, you know, different audiences, you know, are interested in one type of cinema, but I think there's definitely something cultural going on, because it's not so much that they're behind the curve in terms of technology, and some countries like China and Korea, Japan are really pushing 3D cinema in ways that aren't being pushed elsewhere. So yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see how that pans out and what happens.
What's the next 3D film that you're looking forward to most?
Probably Mad Max. Everyone's looking forward to the Avengers, but I'm looking forward to Mad Max.
So am I. Yeah. I'm so excited to see
I think
that,
it's either going to be incredible or absolutely horrendous, but I'm hoping for incredible.
I think it'll be incredibly horrendous.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, no, you're dead right. That's fantastic. We should think. I'm going to set this task to Kaylee, because she's smarter than I am.
Mm-hmm.
We should think about a question or some kind of task for our listeners in order to be able to win a copy of Miriam's book.
Honestly, I just want to know what everyone's favourite 3D film is.
Yeah.
And
we won't judge. Maybe why. No,
might
totally
laugh at you. On the inside.
Yeah, that's right. We won't laugh at you
no.
on Twitter.
Hey, I'm the one excited about Magic Mike the Musical, so you guys are fine.
And Magic Mike XXL coming out later on this year. Okay, so Miriam Ross's book, 3D Cinema. It's published by
Palgrave Macmillan.
And I noticed that there is no price on the reverse of this book. Is that
Is your picture in the book?
I know there's no picture of me in the book. There's some pictures of some of the films, but not of me.
Oh, damn.
Is that publishing? Is that the nature of it?
That is academic publishing. If you look at the front cover, which obviously listeners can't see, I am in the front cover because we did the photograph up at the university.
Oh,
and it's my students, and hidden amongst them is me.
So there you go. You did.
That totally is you. I can see you.
Look, so there you go. Are you able to say how much it would cost a normal citizen to purchase?
I can say it's an academic press, so they unfortunately are very expensive. So it's normally around about the $120 mark.
I think this is possibly the most expensive prize that we've ever offered.
Yes.
On Rancho Notorious. On that basis alone, yes, you will want a copy of this. And it's entirely possible that we will get Miriam to autograph it before she leaves tonight so that you will get a very unique, listen to me.
It's a very fancy book. It has like pull quotes from you know, other people who read the book and recommend it. It's hardcover.
Oh yeah. This will impress. It's not quite like a glossy coffee table book, but it will look good on a coffee table.
It will. You look smart.
Yeah, indeed. All right.
And you will be smarter.
So let us know what your favorite 3D film is and why, and we will pick a winner sometime between now and a fortnight hence.
We'll get together and pick one.
All right, time to talk about something that's not three-dimensional in terms of its technology, but possibly three-dimensional in terms of its story. Who knows? Oh, that was a good segue. That was a great segue. I've been doing this a long time. Don't mock me.
Oh, play the trailer.
Ok, alors je t'explique, en gros, si on a 48 heures pour aider les types à sortir, parfois moins, donc faut se manier.
Bonjour, c'est quoi votre nom?
Samba Cissé.
Vas-y, note, Alice.
En fait, je travaille dans la restauration depuis plusieurs années déjà. J'avais fait une demande de titre de séjour, ils m'ont embarqué.
Putain de sa race.
C'est ça, j'ai pensé aussi.
Je note pas ça.
All right, Samba. This was one of the... Now, somebody who represents the French Film Festival might be able to tell me how successful it was within the French Film Festival.
Yes. Well, it's actually still running within the French Film Festival. We still have our closing night coming up in Palmerston North and Hamilton. And it has basically been selling out. It was our closing night film. Just exclusive one-off screenings in every...
One screening in each location.
In each location, which was very exciting for us because, of course, the two directors who directed The Untouchables, who also won over our audiences in the Bonjour de Stars clip, they were the two guys talking about, we'll come to New Zealand if you make us onion rings.
They were cute. They were the cute onion rings.
They're very cute.
Yeah.
We wish we could have got them out. You know. So cute. Anyway, Samba is their new film starring the handsome and very tall Omar Sy and Tahar Rahim, who many will recognize from The Past, another very good French film.
The Past, that's the
Farhadi.
Iranian. Yeah, the Farhadi.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry. Iranian, French.
French-Iranian. I was wondering where I'd seen him before, and now you'd... That's great. Brilliant.
Yes. Although a very different character in Samba.
Mm.
So Samba is the name of our main character, played by Omar Sy. He is living in Paris. I assume it's Paris. Without a green card. He's working odd jobs, sending money home to his family and trying not to get arrested. Unfortunately, he gets stuck and, you know, gets taken to a sort of immigration legal alien holding facility where he meets Charlotte Gainsbourg's character, who has had a mental breakdown, left her job, and decided to do charity work by helping with immigration, and they hit it off.
Yeah.
And the story goes forth.
Indeed. And he also meets his mate, the Brazilian character who
introduces
him a little more to the ways of the illegal, because if he's been living in Paris for 10 years with sort of expired papers, hasn't he? Like he wasn't illegal when he he just never got things renewed and never and was turned down for formal immigration status, and so therefore but just kept going. So he's not really that familiar with how difficult it is for the genuinely illegals and the purchase of the fake IDs and all of the rest of it. This was a film that I found much more satisfying than Intouchables. Mm. Intouchables seemed to me one of the most contrived scenarios that you could possibly imagine. And for all of Omar Sy's undoubtable, magnificent, huge film star charisma, like he is one of the great film stars of the world as far as I'm concerned.
Incredible in Mood Indigo. He just stole every scene he was in.
Exactly. And I mean, he's a comedian in France. He's a television comedian doing sketch comedies. That's where they found him. He's got a kind of effortless charisma. I loved the fact that in this film, all of that movie stardom is kind of just brought down to a kind of human level. There's a really lovely level of performance from him, but he still dominates the screen. You know, it's better balanced, it seems to me, than that first film. It's also, from a director's point of view, I think that they've created a better balanced film. As I was coming home to Rancho Notorious tonight, I was listening to a news story on Radio New Zealand about a camp that's been constructed in Calais for the refugees who are waiting for some kind of change to their status, either to be sent back or to be given freedom to stay or to jump the fence and try and catch the boat to England or what have you. And there are thousands of people living in not even a proper campsite. You know, it's like a refugee camp in North Africa or America, but there it is, not America, in Africa, but it's Calais, you know. And listening to that story on the way in, I couldn't help but be reminded of what we saw in Samba. Samba is obviously a more palatable, I think, more, it doesn't go as deep and into the horrors of what those people are experiencing, but it just gives you enough of a hint of it to make the drama work, if you know what I mean. Mm. I thought it was a terrific film, actually.
Yeah, it does have that nice balance of drama and comedy, so it's never too heavy or you know, really bearing down on you and your emotions and your sense of right and wrong. So it is similar to The Intouchables. It is quite light. They do have quite a light touch, and they're very good at sort of maintaining a very comfortable balance throughout the film. So I really enjoyed it.
And did the was it well received as part of the French Film Festival? Like was it in terms of your closing night, did people seek it out?
Oh yeah, definitely. We still have two more to go, but most all of our closing nights did sell out. We had quite a few requests for encores of it, which we couldn't do, unfortunately, because
it's coming out, right?
Contracts and arrangements with festivals and all those good things. But yes, it's also being screened. it was great, and it was nice to have that interview material with the directors as well. And Tom Cardy has published his interview with the directors in the Dominion Post and online, so you can read that as well. Go a little bit deeper into the film. So.
Charlotte Gainsbourg.
I'm not a huge fan.
Yeah, she was an interesting casting choice for this because she's, Omar Sy is one of the warmest screen presences that there's ever been, and she's one of the chilliest. And it was obviously a conscious decision to try and bring those two opposites. You know, he's huge, she's tiny, and she's also not known for her comedic abilities, whereas he's, a very funny guy. What did you think of the about her and the relationship there? Like, I was concerned for a while during the film that, you know, maybe this isn't really working. But
yeah, I thought it was nice how, as his character being so charming and being so funny and sort of this glowing, handsome character, sort of trying to bring Charlotte Gainsbourg character out of her shell and get her to relax. And and the whole thing is her character is very uptight, which I think Charlotte Gainsbourg just always plays uptight anyway. but it was nice to see her smile on screen and have be this like uneasy, doesn't really underconfident character. So it was nice to see something a little bit different from her, but all like, I just can't get the image of Nymphomaniac out of my head. And I'm like,
too soon. You will never get the Nymphomaniac out of your head.
Too soon, Charlotte Gainsbourg. Just please, no.
Yeah. So anyway. two words.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. We're just going to.
Oh, I don't know.
You've only had 2 weeks.
I've seen it like, I saw it like a month ago. I guess I can't think of two words.
See, now you know how I feel every single week.
Oh, I feel like am I allowed to do two word reviews for this? It's like, this is part of
you're
my
thinking,
job.
Really? You're going to do that? Okay, all right, I'll let you off.
French Charmer. Ugh. Oh, that's a terrible two-word review.
No, it's better than mine because my two words are ends well. And. Because it does.
Oh, I guess.
Right? Now, at this point, before we move on to the next stage, you know, I was thinking today about how on my tombstone, it's going to read, Dan Slevin, inventor of the two-word review. And it's like, because I see people using this all the time, this two-word review, mm-hmm. and it's like, it's a wonderful thing. We've got people writing to us on Twitter with two-word reviews and what have you, and here I am, I'm responsible for this thing, and I am terrible at them, and I feel kind of embarrassed that I've inflicted this on the world, and I cannot even stand by my own creation. I fall at the feet of the people who can do this properly.
Yeah. To be fair, the next episode we record, I will be on my 1 week break, so I can really dedicate two-word reviews next episode, I
You'll
promise.
You'll be on your A game.
I'll be on my A game, I promise.
All right.
Friend of a friend of Rancho Notorious, director Michelle MacLaren has left DC's Wonder Woman project. Ooh. Both parties describe the separation as being due to creative differences. So that means someone was being a dick.
Yeah, and three guesses. And but there's all these people on Twitter saying, oh, if DC's fired her from a comic book franchise, maybe she could go to Marvel and she can do Captain Marvel because it's about a woman and women should direct films about women. And it's like, oh, please get over yourself.
In more positive news for female directors, Cannes announced this week that Emmanuelle Berco's La Tête Haute would be the opening night screening. They kind of blew it at the same time by saying in their press release that it was the first time a woman had received the honor. In fact, Diane Curry's opened the 1987 festival, good year, with her film Un Homme Amoureux.
Yeah. Nice work, PR department.
One of Rancho Notorious's favorite actresses, Olivia Munn, has been announced in the role of Psylocke in the next X-Men movie, X-Men Apocalypse.
People were very excited about this, and I'm not quite sure why, apart from the fact that, you know, Olivia Munn getting a job is a fantastic thing, but I've never heard of Psylocke before. Like, what? Are we really scratching the bottom of the barrel, aren't we?
No, Psylocke is a thing.
So, well, next, I read the story, and I thought, a comic book character called Psylocke. Does that mean that, you know, it's like a Venetian moneylender with psychic powers? Boom. If that's what I thought when I first read it. And then I thought, and then it said Olivia Munn. And I went, that's not who I'd pictured in my head.
Although, you know, she's
who
flexible.
Knows? Yeah, sure. That's right. Well, she can do anything, I imagine.
Yes. In other scintillating news, The Hollywood Reporter reported earlier this week that Ryan Reynolds has been hit by a car in a Vancouver parking lot, but was not injured. Brian Montague, spokesman for Vancouver Police, had no further details except that the driver fled the scene. In other exciting news,
that's about a squillion hits, by the way. If you're, you know, if for the Hollywood Reporter, if you're clickbaiting, Ryan Reynolds hit by car uninjured. That's your headline. Boom.
Also,
like free money.
Yeah, a friend of mine was in Vancouver, standing around trying to catch a glimpse of him in his Deadlock outfit, and it was pouring rain, and he was nice enough to wave to them.
Deadlock, so. Deadpool.
Deadpool. Ugh. Psylocke, Deadpool, Deadlock.
We should be writing these things.
We should.
All right. Look,
speaking of, we should be writing these things.
We should be.
Let's go on to something we probably could have written better.
Yeah, indeed. All right. So, boom.
Hello?
Dominic Toretto. You don't know me.
You're about to.
Looks like the sins of London have followed us home.
We're being hunted.
Shaw lives in a world that doesn't play by your rules. Like it or not, you and your friends are a part of it now.
I don't have friends. I got family.
Fast and Furious 7. I'm looking at the clock here, and before we started the show today, it was suggested that we have some kind of timer that goes off at the hour mark, and we just like all just shut down at the end of that hour. Yeah. We're 3 minutes and 40 seconds away from that moment, ladies and gentlemen. So, okay. In order to try and
get to dessert faster.
Get to dessert. Well, exactly. This is a very rare Rancho Notorious, ladies and gentlemen. We had dinner first before the show, so it's amazing that we're awake at all. Fast and Furious 7. I'm going to throw to Dr. Miriam.
I wish I had something really intelligent to say about this movie. I don't know if anyone wants to try and do the plot. There's a bad guy.
Okay.
And a terrorist.
There's the brother of a bad guy.
Yeah, so here we go.
And a terrorist, you go down.
If you saw Fast and Furious 6, you'll know that at the end of the film, after the car chase along the longest airport runway in the world.
Right! That's how it ended.
Yeah, Luke Evans, the Welsh bad guy in that film, who was a good guy in The Hobbit, so don't get confused. But anyway, the bad guy, he was cleaned out, and at the very end, a very stern-looking Jason Statham turns up and makes a face, furrows his brow, exactly, and it's like, ooh, trouble. Trouble's coming. But, so there we go, which adds yet another action hero star or action star to the franchise that's already, I mean, it's
more. I feel like it was only a matter of time until they just like threw Jason Statham into the big bubbling pot of Fast and Furious.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's turning into the Expendables, isn't it? Because, I mean, Kurt Russell turns up in this one.
I know.
Right?
His name came up at the credits, I actually shouted, like, what?
So for no apparent reason, Kurt Russell's in this, and they just keep.
Oh, he didn't have an eye patch, though. He should have an eye patch.
Wasted. So they're throwing more and more into it. Stallone will turn up in the next one, I'm sure. I mean, yeah. The Rock apparently only did 5 days.
Well, because he's barely in it. I was so excited. I love Dwayne Johnson. And I was like, yes, Dwayne Johnson, come at me, bro. And
exactly. No. In a hospital bed for 5 days.
But if the 3D version of his muscles in that hospital bed will be impressive.
Oh, my gosh.
They were round and big. And
you've just reminded me of my favourite line of any film review ever. And it was, it's actually a television review. Clive James, the great reviewer, talking about Arnold Schwarzenegger back in the 1980s. And he's described him as looking like a condom filled with walnuts. And that's The Rock now, whenever I see him. Yes, I mean, just extraordinary physique, even in a hospital bed. And doesn't he just, like, bust out of the arm plaster at one point?
Yeah, that's, like, one of the very overwrought jokes, is he's watching the Hulk in his hospital bed, and then he's like, oh, no, I can see fire. Oh, I better get up. He's like, and just, like, hulks out of his cast, straps up, and then just refuses to die in the last 5 minutes of the film.
It is nuts, isn't it?
It's insane, but yeah. That's what makes it so much fun.
But it didn't used to be nuts. Like, the very first Fast and Furious was cool. Was indie.
But yeah, there's a point in the film where I think it's one of the characters, Roman, says, oh, it's crazy, like, you know, first you got me to blow up a tank, then you got me to blow up a plane, and he's kind of listing the past few films, and he goes, and now we're going to do this. And you just think, there's nowhere else for them to go. I think, like, next film they're going to have to go to outer space or somewhere. I don't know how they can get crazier than what they've done in this film.
Yeah, they went...
And to be fair to them, they've managed to do it while still making... still trying to make you believe that these characters are just down-to-earth, working-class Los Angeles guys, you know?
They drive a car through not one, but two towers on, like, the 100th floor in Abu Dhabi.
It's... I mean, like, it's almost... It's critic-proof, first of all, so, yeah. You know, it is what it is. I felt like it was more... contrived and more, it was trying harder. The most effortless fun Fast and Furious is the Brazil one, and I don't, that's five, right? And I don't, that it would seem to me that when you go to Brazil, life just gets like that anyway. You know, you go and make a car chase film in Brazil, it's gonna be fun, it's like samba. So, but you know, and then they went to London, and London has the ability to suck all the fun out of life just by being there, and it certainly seemed to do that to the film. And now they're sort of just doing that globe trotting all over the world, wherever, whoever's investing in the film thing, Abu Dhabi and whatever.
Oh God.
And it just seemed to be trying too hard to top itself. You know what I mean?
They also had a kind of difficult tension because there was, you know, the very sad and untimely death of Paul Walker. So I think, you know, the sense in the film that they wanted to put in some poignant, you know, life is about something deeper and meaningful. But then they also wanted to make sure there was still women's butts and bikinis. Mm. And they didn't really seem to know how they were going to match up those two
things. Beginning, there is so much, like, bum and fanny in the beginning. It's outrageous. I'm like, how do you... What? Like, it was...
Somebody wrote that in a script.
Somebody wrote, like, butt.
And then they went to Abu Dhabi, and they had butts and bikinis in the palace in Abu Dhabi.
Which would never happen. And then, like, the slow mo... Oh.
Don't start me on what would never happen. But...
Anyway.
The Paul Walker thing is interesting to me, yes. Because...
It's very important.
I think that one of the reasons why the film has been so successful is because there's an element of... I think a lot of people think it's over, that the franchise is over, that this is the that seven is the kind of a natural end to an arc or whatever, and because you can't do it without Paul Walker, and you know, it seems to me that it's made so much money, no one is can possibly leave it behind, you know. But there's a sentimentality to it all the way through. There's a knowingness about his anticipated absence. That even when, you know, even the scenes where he's alive in it, you know, and that, you know, like he, when shooting it, they couldn't possibly have known what was going to happen. They've managed to cut it in such a way that it's got a poignancy, you know, that's very clever. I mean, it would make a really interesting film studies text to see how something that was shot a certain way can be cut in a way to make it feel very, very different in the context of the rest of the film.
And the interesting thing about the whole Paul Walker thing is that Weta Digital did all of the facial rotoscoping or facials for Paul Walker for the film,
or for the bits that he wasn't real in.
Yeah, and Variety
and his brother was the body.
Yeah, he has his two brothers, and they look very, the three of them look very similar. But there's an article in Variety magazine trying to talk about, you know, how much was shot and, you know, how much was replaced, and everyone's staying very quiet. And it was specific in this article that no one from Weta is talking about it. It's all very
and
hush-hush.
Fair enough too.
Which is fair enough.
But I did spend most of the film, like most of the interest in the film for me was sitting there going, real, not real, real, not real. Mm. And there's a whole, what... I think from a script point of view, there's something very sensitive that they've done. And this is my second massive spoiler of the night, so sorry to everybody.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, fast forward. That they didn't kill the character off. I thought that was a really, really nice, honourable thing to do for him. But it must have been weird as heck to go to that beach and to shoot a scene where they're basically saying goodbye to a ghost.
Mm.
You know, I was looking at that and going, that must have just been freaky as heck to shoot, because he's palpably not there.
Mm. Mm.
Boy, yeah.
There was a very good article in The Guardian about, there's a kind of cult around Paul Walker right now. There's lots of, specifically bumper stickers on cars that have slogans along the lines of, well, you know, he died as he lived and things. And so I think there's something to be said about the fact that film hasn't played into that and hasn't celebrated this, but it's actually...
In narrative terms, he opts out of all of that, doesn't he? And I think that that's actually, it's a very interesting choice and a very worthy choice. And I think that the whole thing was handled as sensitively as a film of this nature, shall we say, was going to handle.
I got emotional. I got a little bit choked up, like, at the end. It was, like, super cheesy.
I mean, it goes on. It does go on. I mean, they crack on about it for a while, and the car's diverging on the road and all that sort of stuff. But...
Montage.
Oh, now this is an interesting thing, and actually, I'm glad you've reminded me of this. But the montage, I mean, it's a nicely handled montage. But when they go back to some of the early films, the film grain pops off the screen like it's just massive, and I look at that and go, oh yeah, that's right. That's what films used to look like.
But it's
film grain, wow.
Incredible thinking. It's 15 years since the first one.
And neither Walker nor Diesel wanted to do any more after the first one. Like, they all tried to get out, and now it's their living.
What else has Vin Diesel doing?
There are so many aspects of this franchise that I think are fascinating and more interesting culturally and sociologically than many, many other big Hollywood movies, that, you know, and much more interesting than what's actually up on the screen. Like, if Paul Walker hadn't died, this film was nothing. You know, there was it had no emotional heft to it at all. Not that there ever is. I mean, they do talk about, through all the films, all family and this, that, and the other, and it's all. But, you know, I wouldn't have cared anything about any of them. So it's only that kind of manufactured sentiment at the end that sends you out feeling kind of satisfied.
Mm.
And yes, and they'll be on Mars next, I'm sure.
Yeah. But also they sort of updated the franchise by them having to save a hacker. You know.
Oh yeah.
It's all about global surveillance.
And the hacker, there's a twist in who that hacker was, which seemed very progressive. And we won't spoil it, but
somebody was thinking, but. What are they? Who else can they bring in to refresh the franchise? Like, are they going to go to old school?
I think they're going to keep the hacker
and Jason Statham.
Jason Statham must be trying to bank as much money as possible before he can't do this anymore. Like, I'm sure that he's been looking at Schwarzenegger.
I don't feel like he's aged though. Like, is it him? Is it some sort of, like, weird Jason Statham avatar that just lives on forever at, like, the same age?
Yeah. I mean, he hasn't learned any acting.
I would never believe that The Rock would not win in a fight between Jason Statham and The Rock. I'm sorry. The Rock is huge, and he used to be a wrestler. Like, there is no way you're coming out of that fight, Jason Statham. I don't care how British badass you are.
Jason Statham, former British Olympic diver.
That's right.
Yeah, that was his claim to fame before.
Could you imagine him diving?
And he was the
dive now.
And he was the fourth wheel in Lock, Stock, and all those smoking barrels. Like, he was not the one that anyone thought was going to be the movie star out of that.
No.
And everybody else has fallen by the wayside, and he's the one. It is amazing. Somebody should write a book on Jason Statham. Maybe I will. All right. Let's wrap this up with two words for
Yes, let's
Fast
wrap it up with that.
Fast and Furious.
My two-word review for Fast and Furious 7 is fast fun.
Right.
I think this isn't the end of the franchise, so I'm going to say escalating fury.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's good when we get proper people in here.
Academics,
exactly.
With their
thinkers.
Fancy words.
mine for Fast and Furious 7 is nut job. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is our show for this fortnight. If you've enjoyed this episode, you can subscribe to us at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious, where you'll find ways to communicate with us via email, or you can make a comment on the website. We love either or.
Yes, you can follow us on Twitter at Rancho Podcast, where we tweet about things we think are totally interesting and sometimes silly. And you can also interact with us on Letterboxd. Thanks to Reese Pie, our username is Rancho Notorious, all one word.
I'm so far behind in my own personal Letterboxd. I got good at it for a while and then I forgot, and I just want to apologize to everybody. There's going to be big gaps in my diary. Anyway, now something else that I've been meaning to mention, and that is that in the off weeks when we're not on the air, you can get a taste of Rancho Notorious by listening to another podcast, which is recorded here, called The Year of Reading Massively. Johnny Potts and Kelly Dare and a number of other assorted guests come in to Rancho Notorious once a month to talk about big books. It's a once a month, and they're basically reading the 12 biggest novels. Maybe not even novels, actually, but because the last one was The Second Sex, huge book. First one, War and Peace, obviously, start with the very biggest. And so Johnny Potts, who's the host and producer of the show, is reading all of them, and then various special guests come in to I think I'm doing The Executioner's Song in October. But yeah, so if you want to get a sense of Rancho Notorious while we're not here, other people come in sometimes and record in here and they talk about...
Or if you just like books.
Yeah, or if you just like
and
books.
You want a really good book podcast.
Yeah, it's a very interesting book podcast. They, I'm afraid, spoiler alert, they do talk about what happens in the books. But you sort of have to. But luckily...
If you don't feel like reading a book or listening to the audiobook,
Well, I don't need to read War and Peace now because, you know, they did it for me. Spoilers. In an hour. So, pretty good. So, yes, we'll put the link to The Year of Reading Massively in the show notes for you. So, this show, the one that we're talking about now, is a Funerals and Snakes production, Season 2, which must be coming to an end soon, actually. How many episodes in a season?
18?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah,
we should check.
Yeah, we're nearly there. I mean, we make it up anyway, but it doesn't matter. Anyway, the Season 2 is executive produced by Robert Catto, Random Films, Claire Corray, Mark Cuby, Anthony S. Pratt, Fred Thompson, and Matthew Buchanan. The theme music is Ennio Morricone's The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly by Los Plantronics. You can buy that at the iTunes store. We're going to play you out with some more music. Now, one of the highlights of, or one of the best things about Samba is that it has a magnificent soundtrack, including compositions by Ludovico Einaudi, and the other half of the soundtrack is Latin and funk classics like this, what you are listening to at the moment, from 1972, Stevie Wonder introducing his wife at the time, Sayurita. This is a song from the album called Sayurita called To Know You Is To Love You. Next fortnight on the show, it's Avengers fortnight. It's the Marvel Universe. We're going to have a special guest, Andy James, who has been re-watching all of the Marvel Universe in anticipation of the second Avengers film, and we will be dissecting all of that in a fortnight's time. So looking forward very much to that. Special thanks to our guest Miriam Ross. Please hurry back to Rancho Notorious soon if you are able. extra special bravos to my partner Karen, who makes sure that everyone who visits us here at Rancho Notorious is well fed, well watered, well looked after.
And thank you to my partner Ian, who's also here and was our Abu Dhabi fact checker on Fast and Furious 7.
Yes, indeed. Once again, thanks to you, Kaylee. Thanks to all of you for listening. We're off. The script says we're off for dinner. Did that already?
We're off to dessert.
Dessert, indeed. Cheese and crackers. So good evening from me.
Good evening from me.